Well, thank you very much for coming. This is my first trip to Australia. It's been on my so-called bucket list for decades, and I should have been here many years ago. I've had a strong affection for Australia and its history. I know about its role in the space program. And I would like to have gotten to Brisbane and to see some of the historical sites related to Apollo there. I want to mention that one of my affections for Australia comes from one of my favorite writers expatriated to Australia in the early 1950s, a man by the name of Neville Shute, who I think he came around 1952. He lived until 1960. And he was an aeronautical engineer and wrote his autobiography called Slide Rule. And he also then became a very famous novelist, perhaps best known for On the Beach, which was made into a Hollywood film. But he's written most of his books deal with aviation themes. And a lot of them, once he came to Australia, they deal with Australia as well. So I just wanted to sort of give credit and acknowledge I've read his books. I think he has about 20-some, and I've read each one at least twice, so I have great affection for him. I want to make a comment about accents, not yours, but mine. I grew up in northeastern Indiana around a town called Fort Wayne. Fort Wayne is approximately 50 miles to the northwest of Wapakoneta, Ohio, which is the hometown of Neil Armstrong. Probably the most asked question I've ever been given about the book is, why did Neil choose you? I never asked him. Once he gave me the green light, I thought it would be kind of foolish for me to say, why did you agree to let me write your book? But we had a lot of things in common. Our families were both farming families, and his accent, if you're hearing my accent, it's really Neil's accent. We have someone in the audience today, the fellow from Auglaize County. Would he raise his hand for me that's here today? Right here. And I immediately knew when he came up to have the book signed, I immediately asked if you were an American, and then to realize that he comes from Auglaize County, Ohio, which is the county where Wapakoneta is, and actually has some connections to the Armstrong family. So it's a small world. Tonight I want to talk to you about a pretty simple, direct question. Why Neil Armstrong? But it's a question that is pretty complicated to answer thoroughly. And that's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to try to explain to you what it was what the circumstances were that led to Armstrong not only being the commander of Apollo 11, but also being the first man to step out onto the lunar surface. And there's many levels to this discussion. As a university professor, I always start by getting some bearing of my audience, at least to see where the troublemakers are. But I just want to sort of do a little bit of a poll. How many of you were actually alive in July 1969 when the first lunar landing took place? Yeah. Maybe about half or a little bit over half. The numbers for this constantly change, but something like 80% of the globe's population today was not alive in July 1969. And that's a rather depressing statistic for those of us that were. But it means that there are a lot of people, and the young people, I'm really happy to see so many students in the audience. This is history. I mean, for some, maybe even ancient history. Go back to 1969, and of course, you probably have seen polls. They sort of routinely show up how many people believe that the moon landings actually occurred. Now, I assume everybody here would raise their hand and say yes, but with a lot of the polls, it's like 50% when you're talking to young people, about 50% think that it happened. I wanted to thank Peter Elward and Lynn Halperin, who they're Facebook friends of mine, and we've been communicating about space history for many years. When Lynn and I were talking about this on the way over today, about 50% of the young people not believing that this necessarily happened, Lynn pointed out that there was a survey that said, when asked how many do you think we will get to Mars in our lifetime, like it was 90% believe that. So 90% believe that, but only 50% believe that we actually got to the moon. So there's some inconsistency there that is maybe hard to explain. The question why Neil Armstrong is a question it gives us insights not just into Neil and not just into the astronaut corps and not just into really not even just into the Apollo program. I think it has a lot of levels of complexity to it, and I think as I take you through this tonight, you'll not only learn a lot about Neil and what was going on in the Apollo program, but there are some larger lessons, I think, about science and technology and discovery and exploration that come out through this analysis. So I hope to share some of these lessons as we go through this lecture. Now, Neil agreed to do one piece of kind of publicity when the book came out in 2005. He agreed to do an interview for the American television program 60 Minutes, which is probably, I'm not sure, is that shown here from time to time? And Neil was kind of reluctant to do 60 Minutes. Honestly, it's for some people, they consider it to have a liberal bias and kind of muckraking in some respects. But Neil agreed to do it. And it turned out to be a very nice, about a 15-minute feature story. It should have been longer. But in that interview with Ed Bradley, who you see here, Ed is a well-known CBS reporter who died of cancer not too many months after this piece with Armstrong, when Ed Bradley asked Neil, why do you seem to be so reticent to acknowledge the honor and the fame that you've had because of this role, this epic historical role as the first man on the moon. When Ed Bradley asked him that question, this is what you see what Neil answered. I wasn't chosen to be first. I was just chosen to command that flight. Circumstance put me in that particular role. And Neil was consistent about this, expressing this point of view throughout his lifetime after the Apollo landing, that the Apollo program was kind of like an iceberg. You know, the astronauts were visible at the top of the iceberg for everybody to see, but so much of what was going on, some 400,000 Americans and there were Australians and Canadians and people, other peoples around the world that were involved in this moon landing program. And Neil understood that he was at the he was at the visible pinnacle of this iceberg, but there was all this underneath that nobody really, that the public wouldn't know about. And Neil felt a responsibility to share the story with all of these people that he knew had made such incredible contributions. So, unfortunately, when he makes this kind of comment to the public, circumstance put me in that particular role. You know, it's going to take me about 50 minutes to explain those circumstances to you, and Neil would never have the time to explain that to a public in a media sense. So when he would make comments like this, a lot of the general audience would say, "Well, what does he really mean by that? Circumstance put me in that particular role." It's a generalization, but unfortunately, if it wasn't just in that setting, you just don't have the time to explain really what was going on. So that's my question for us tonight, and why was Neil first? And I'm going to address this kind of in two parts. The first part, more detailed analysis of exactly how the crew assignments and the missions were laid out and how it just then happened that Apollo 11 became the landing mission and he became its commander. So that's kind of part one. And then part two is an explanation of, well, what is it in Neil's story that led him to the place where he could be considered for this historic role? What qualities did he have? What experiences did he have beyond the circumstantial situation that explains why he became the commander of Apollo 11? What was it in his life and in his career trajectory that got him to the place where he was going to be considered for this role? It's a different sort of question that I'm asking than the question that you see on the screen now. I mean, we could, as historians, ask, well, why Wilbur and Orville Wright? Why these bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio? By the way, Dayton's not far from Wapakoneta. It's about 60 miles, 50 miles south of Wapakoneta. So Neil was sort of brought up in this same area. But when you're asking questions, why Wilbur and Orville? You know, you could go back in aviation history, and you could go back into the 19th century and look at the different people that were trying to figure out the problem of powered flight, heavier-than-air flight, and why some of their approaches were leading to advances, like Otto Lilienthal or Alphonse Pinault in France. If you're telling the history of aviation and how you get to the invention of the airplane, you have to talk about these people. But how is it then that they led to some advances, but they didn't really solve the problem, and these two guys did? How was it that Wilbur and Orville were able to figure it out? And I think biographically, you've got to understand where these two young men come from, how they related to one another, how they went about solving creative technological problems. And you can explain then. You can explain, and I do this to my students, you can explain why it was Wilbur and Orville, of all the people that were in the science and engineering community that were addressing what some called the problem of the century, trying to accomplish heavier-than-air flight, why it was these two guys that did it. Very, very worthwhile question. It takes a long time to explain that, too. But it's not the same sort of question that I'm asking about Neil. You could also ask, why Charles Lindbergh? Why was it this U.S. airmail pilot, barnstormer, why was it him that not only made the first solo nonstop flight across the Atlantic, but what was it about him and his achievement that so captured and enthralled not only Americans, but people all over the world? Again, it's a very worthwhile question to ask if you're studying aviation history, but it's a different sort of question than what I'm addressing in terms of why Armstrong became the first man on the moon. Different sort of question. I talked to Neil about Lindbergh. Neil actually met Lindbergh. He actually was assigned during the Apollo 8 flight in December 68. He was assigned the job of taking Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh around the Cape Canaveral for that launch. So he got to know Lindbergh a little bit then. And then after Apollo 11, Neil had some meetings with Lindbergh at the Society of Experimental Test Pilots. There was a meeting out in California. And Neil told me that the one piece of advice that that Lindbergh gave Armstrong was never sign an autograph. And Neil told me for 20-some years, Neil signed autographs to anybody that asked, and he never charged anything for them. In the early 90s, after the Internet boomed and a lot of forgeries of his signatures happened, he stopped signing autographs cold. I mean, if Sister Teresa had asked for an autograph, he wouldn't give it to her. He would let you have a picture, if it was convenient. But he told me that he wishes that he had accepted and followed Lindbergh's advice from the start and never signed an autograph. But in terms of understanding Lindbergh's achievement, you can see what Neil said to me, that they were very individual achievements. There were a very limited number of people that were involved, and then there was Lindbergh. Very different sort of set of circumstances than from Apollo, where you have a large bureaucracy and you have an aerospace industry. You've got a lot of people and a lot of agencies that are at work. It's a different sort of question than asking why Lindbergh. And here you see what Neil said. In the case of the Apollo program, it was an effort of national will. Hundreds of thousands of people were involved. And Neil was always uncomfortable to be the one that was being set out held up as the most important person to talk about in terms of this national achievement. Neil just didn't feel that way about it. He honestly didn't. So here's my first lesson in terms of understanding maybe some bigger issues that relate to Armstrong. And why the Apollo program succeeded, and what then explains Armstrong's role in it. Throughout the manned space program, which today we'd call the human spaceflight program, tasks and responsibilities inside of NASA were delegated down. And those who didn't know how to do what they were being asked to do were expected to go find out how to do it. And they did. And this is a type of organizational culture that I think... And Neil and I talked about this. It was what helped create so many unsung heroes in the Apollo program. There are so many. There are dozens of people that are worth talking about. Names that if I said them to you, unless you're really a devotee like Peter and Len and some of the others are, you probably wouldn't even know those names. Names like Emil Schiesser or Floyd Bennett or Kenny Kleinkonnect. I mean, and these are people that Neil told me when I started working on the biography. I said, Neil, who should I talk to about your life and about Apollo in particular? And I thought he'd be mentioning the other astronauts and the major figures in the space program. No, I mean the first guy Neil mentioned, he said you need to talk to Emil Schiesser. I had no idea who Emil Schiesser was. He was an engineer at Johnson Space Center who was in mission planning, and he was a very good applied mathematician, and he taught Neil a lot about orbital mechanics, and that was the guy Neil thought I should talk to. I had no idea who the guy was. A lot of unsung heroes, I think, because of the organizational culture of NASA at that time, I'm afraid it's not so much like this today, but at that time it delegated down and you figured out what you needed to know to do it. Another important part of the story goes to the astronaut office operation itself, and to the man who was in charge, who was the chief of the astronaut corps, Deke Slayton. Deke had been one of the Mercury astronauts, but he didn't fly a Mercury mission because he was detected with a heart murmur they thought could be a problem. He eventually flies in the Apollo-Soyuz flight many years later, but through the Apollo program, through Gemini and Apollo, he's the astronaut, chief of the astronaut corps, and he's the main person who puts the crews together. And as Neil talked to me about Slayton and how the crews and commanders, how this was all figured out, Neil made it clear to me that Slayton had this emphasis on selecting commanders. If you selected your best astronauts, if you had good commanders, that was the key to mission success, and then you could slot your other astronauts in. Not that it was, just anybody could be put in anywhere, but the commanders were the key. You get really your best astronauts to command the missions, and then you fill out the crews from there. So that was Slayton's philosophy. And here you can see some other quotes from Neil. That Deke's principal concern was getting qualified, capable commander each flight. He took the position that all the guys had come through the process, they were all qualified to fly, and they should be able to accept any task they were given. That's not to say that for particular missions you didn't have to have specialized training. I mean, missions were different, and the commanders had to be trained up to that particular mission. But Slayton's philosophy was that all the commanders should be able to do that, should be in a position once they're given the specific assignment of a mission, they should all be capable of doing the job well. So that's important to remember, because if I have any thesis to this story, in at least the first part of this story, why Neil, It's nothing was preordained in this that Armstrong was going to turn out to be the commander of the first landing or that he was going to be the first man on the moon. There was nothing preordained about it. NASA had not said, or Slayton hadn't said back in the mid-60s, oh, it's going to be Armstrong. Nothing of the sort. It was how things unfolded, and a lot of things happened to change what looked like might be the case. Again, from Slayton's point of view, any of them could do it. And I believe, and Neil believed, that any of them could have done it. You know, if it could have been, if Borman had been given that assignment, or Pete Conrad had done the assignment, Neil felt that they could do, and Slayton had felt that same way, that in a sense that the commanders were almost interchangeable, that they were all so good that they could all take on a mission and train up to it. In Deke's autobiography, he actually says that if Gus Grissom had not died in the Apollo fire, along with Roger Chaffee and Ed White, that Deke, his first choice for who should have commanded the first landing was Gus Grissom. Gus had been a fellow Mercury astronaut, part of the original seven. He had also flown Gemini, and he was scheduled to fly Apollo. And Deke says in his autobiography that if Gus hadn't died, that he would have wanted Gus to be the commander of the first landing. Now, whether that really would have happened that way or not, you know, nobody knows because he died in the fire. It kind of flies in the face of the philosophy that I just expressed, that all the commanders were, you know, that they all should be able to do it. So if that's the case, then why would Deke sort of think, well, Gus needs to do it? They were close friends. They were both Air Force, you know, pilot, test pilots. So maybe Deke would have pushed Grissom to be that landing commander. I really don't believe that would have worked out that way, honestly. I think I don't believe that it would have necessarily, if Gus had lived, that Deke would have necessarily pushed that the way he describes it in his autobiography. So, again, it gets a little detailed here, and I'll try not to get caught up in the details, because when you're talking about crew assignments and how the assignments change, my basic point is that the first landing could have been commanded by any of these guys. It could have happened sooner than Apollo 11. It could have happened later than Apollo 11. And it didn't have to be Neil. There was nothing preordained. Nobody had made this judgment. It has to be Armstrong. It just depended on how things worked out in the program. If you've studied the Apollo program, you know that there were different mission types that had to be fulfilled, from the A mission to the B to the C and D to the first landing, which was going to be the G mission. And each one of these missions, as was originally laid out in the spring of 1967, each one of these missions had to be sort of checked off before you moved to the next one. That was at least the original theory. And they weren't sure if you had to do A and B and C, well, you might be able to do that in one flight, or it might take two or three. But if you were going to take it incrementally, you had to, you know, you weren't going to go do D until you had C done. Well, that was the theory. That was the way it was laid out. But there were circumstances that were going to change that. Wait a minute, went the wrong way. And then there were going to be mission types after the G mission, after the landing mission. There was an H and an I and a J mission that was going to take the Apollo program farther. One thing for the students to perhaps, maybe you don't know this, but as the Apollo program was moving ahead, in the end, there are seven. The last lunar landing is Apollo 17 in December of 1972. When Apollo's getting going, nobody's expecting the mission to be the last flight to be in December of 1972. There was the idea that this was going to just keep continuing, that lunar exploration was just going to continue. There'd be there were plans for an 18 and a 19 and a 20, but after, you know, the first landing, a lot of people started to lose interest. Like, okay, you know, U.S. has beaten the Russians to the moon landing. Okay, we've done that. So why do we keep spending so much money? This is an era of a lot of turbulence in society all around the world. I really don't know how much it affected Australia in the period 68, 69, 70, but it's the era of Vietnam and the controversies over the Vietnam War. Richard Nixon is elected in 1968. He's not a great fan of NASA. He's, you know, there's budget cutting that's even taking place in NASA before Nixon's elected. Long story short, the Apollo program, which the organizers of the space program thought was going to continue and grow and develop into more and more exploration and then moving on to Mars, it sort of got derailed. The budgets weren't there. NASA had to just sort of shut off the Apollo program with Apollo 17. They did do the Apollo-Soyuz mission after. They used Apollo technology to do a Skylab mission, which was really the first space station. But the idea was, with these mission types, was this is going to continue. I mean, this is going to build, and it's a future for America in space that's not just going to stop, you know, in the early 70s. Crew assignments. Again, I don't have the time to get real complicated about this, but you can see in this slide for Apollo 17, which was going to do the C mission, and Apollo 8, the D, and Apollo 9, the E mission, you can see how the prime crews at the top and the backup crews at the bottom, how they were being first set out by Deke Slayton. This would have still been current in the era of 1967, let's say. In terms of the later crew assignments by the spring of 1967, they really weren't clear yet. And it wasn't even clear whether 10, was 10 going to be doing the E, F, or G mission, or was, you know, what was 11 going to do, what was 12 going to do. This hadn't been set yet in 1967. One factor that changes the progress of these mission types is the lunar module, which is what you need to land. One of the foremost decisions that NASA made in the entire Apollo program was the so-called mission mode issue. How are you going to get there? And the method that was accepted was something known as lunar orbit rendezvous. It was very controversial when it was first proposed in the early 60s because it was all based on doing a rendezvous in lunar orbit. Well, when this was all being thought about in the early 60s, the United States hadn't done any kind of rendezvous. I mean, John Glenn doesn't get into an orbital flight until February of 62. That's when the lights of Perth get turned on. I think you probably all know a little bit about that. But there, with the acceptance of lunar orbit rendezvous, the key is then that you're building a module that's going to be part of the overall spacecraft that's going to have one responsibility, and that is go down, detach from the command module once you get into lunar orbit, go down and land, do your exploration. The top half of this thing, the ascent stage, will go back up. It will rendezvous and dock with the command module. The astronauts will get into the command module, and they will, you know, the ascent module of the ascent stage of the lunar module will be discarded, and the astronauts head home. Well, so the progress of Apollo in 67 and 68 was absolutely dependent on getting the lunar module done. And Grumman, a company on Long Island in New York, was in the end does a fabulous job with the lunar module, but it's not quite ready to do the missions as they had been laid out by Slayton and the Johnson Space Center. It's not ready for the D mission to test out this module first in Earth orbit and then to do it in lunar orbit even before you try a landing. You have to make sure this module's working. So here's what you're faced with. NASA's faced with this problem. Well, we've got to keep moving because President Kennedy in May of 1961 says we're going to go to the moon and do it by the end of the decade. Well, you know, 1969 was approaching. There were even some within NASA were saying, well, if we can't get it in 1969, we can do it in 1970, and we can say that's still within the decade. It depends on how you define decades. So there was that kind of fudging, you know, in the mind of some people, but they wanted to meet Kennedy's deadline. Well, the darn lunar module wasn't ready. So how do you move ahead? A man named George Lowe, who was in the Office of Manned Spaceflight in Washington, looking at the whole situation, the LEM's not ready. The Soviets seem still to be trying to go to the moon, and that's an altogether different story that, you know, I'd have to tell you at another time, but the Russians are still trying. It's just that the booster, the big booster that they develop, the N-1 rocket, isn't working. It blows up a couple of times, but the Russians are still striving to beat the Americans. George Lowe recognizes that. So he says, since LEM's not ready, what can we do to move things along? And Lowe comes up with an audacious proposal. Let's send a command module circumlunar. Let's send it around the moon and come back. It's not going to have a lunar module with it. Lunar module's not ready. It's just going to have the command module, and which is hooked up with the service module, which has the fuel and other resources needed for the crew. So it's what I call a radical stopgap. There were people that were saying, what? We're going to try to go to the moon now? We still have all of these mission types we've got to prove. But Lowe proposes this. NASA accepts it. And in December 1968, the crew of Apollo 8 flies around the moon. Frank Borman, Bill Anders, Jim Lovell. This was a mission for which Armstrong was the backup commander. For some of you that were alive, I wonder if you agree with me. I remember the Apollo 8 circumlunar flight even better than the lunar landing in some respects. The astronauts read from the book of Genesis on Christmas Eve. I guess it would have been Christmas morning here. But it was very emotional. It was a very dramatic time in the space program. And 1968 had been a terrible year. In the United States and in other parts of the world, student riots in the country, also in Paris, and lots of controversy still with the Vietnam War, the presidential campaign that resulted in Nixon's election, the Chicago Democratic Convention, just a horrible year. And here, this wonderful thing happens at the end of the year: humankind goes around the moon. And we get our first close-up pictures of that moon with the astronauts themselves looking at it and describing it. It's really a magical time in the history of the American space program. But it was done because the lunar module's not ready. And they needed to keep moving along to try to get this end of the decade. So here you are, 21st to 27 December 1968, Borman, Lovell, and Anders. And I was lucky. All three of these men are still living. And, you know, there's a lot of the astronauts from this era that aren't around anymore. But I interviewed Borman, Lovell, and Anders, all three of them, for the Armstrong book. And they were great interviews and had a lot of interesting things to say about Neil.